Coming up on Weekend America.
Sunday is International Forgiveness Day, and here's one place where that should be a big holiday.
Going into San Quentin or any prison for the first time is a pretty amazing experience. I mean, the sounds and the clanks and the guns and the guards.
This hour, inmates get free of vengeance behind bars. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Also this hour, a road trip where the price of gas is the least of your worries.
It just sounded like another one of Dad's road trips where we drive and drive, and he won't stop to go to the bathroom. It's like, oh my gosh.
Adventure awaits on one family's summer vacation. And when's the last time you had a night like this?
I've had a couple of experiences where I woke up the next day and I literally didn't know what day it was or where I was. I had been so deeply asleep.
Music to get you through the night, coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. It's summer, and that means when it comes to getting around, you've got lots of options. Anything from walking to biking to ballooning. This hour, we'll follow a folk musician as he canoes to his gigs in New York. And we'll load up the minivan for an ambitious family road trip. And then we'll journey to forgiveness behind prison bars. What kind of vehicle would you use to travel across the country?
I would like to travel in a Mercedes limousine.
Well, with the price of gas right now, I'd probably pick a Prius to go across the country.
Hot air balloon.
I wish I could go places with a horse and a buggy, to tell you the truth.
We're getting ready to go on a vacation through several states for the world's longest garage sale, which goes from Defiance, Ohio, all the way down to Alabama. And we're going to do it in a truck because we are going to get so many treasures. We need to be able to haul it home.
Here's how much I saved at the garage sales. Here's how much gas I burned driving from Ohio to Alabama in a truck. It must be about the fun.
And you know, it all looks like treasures until you get it home. That's the trick there.
True.
Those voices came from Norman, Oklahoma, Boise, Idaho, and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, this weekend, travelers, including Americans, are pouring into Beijing ahead of next week's Olympics. China has deployed thousands of security workers in airports, on buses and trains. They say they're trained to look for suspicious people in the crush of the crowds. How is that done? Here in the States, the Transportation Security Administration is putting some workers through a week-long training to look for air travelers who show involuntary physical signs of stress, fear, or deception. The TSA won't say how they look for those signs. So we asked a body language expert, Nick Morgan. Welcome to Weekend America.
Thanks, Bill.
There are a lot of popular conceptions about how to spot a liar. Are they talking too fast? Do they avert their eyes? Do their hand go up to their mouth? How accurate are these popular ideas?
Well, the funny thing is that most of the standard things that we think about, like not making eye contact or a false smile or that kind of thing, actually can be indications of lying. But most of us, as we grow up and become adult, we get pretty practiced at little white lies and perhaps even bigger lies. And we learn to squelch those things. So most of us are pretty good at avoiding the obvious dumb things like twitching eyes or eyes that are darting all over the room that signal a lie. But there are plenty of people in this world, I'm afraid, who can look you right in the eye and tell you a lie. And so those kind of cliched and indications of lying aren't terribly reliable.
How do the experts look for signs of nerves or deception?
Well, basically, what you're looking for is some kind of leakage. That is, people try to maintain, and I'm assuming terrorists do the same, normal-looking facial expressions and a normal stance and walk. And what you're looking for is little micro-expressions, little expressions that come and go in the blink of an eye. You can be trained to see them, but mostly for the rest of us, if we're not trained, we don't pick them up.
What are some of the most telling micro-expressions?
Well, here's where it starts to get a little more complicated. What the micro-expressions might reveal is the underlying emotion. So it depends on what that underlying emotion is. I mean, for example, if you meet somebody who gives you an insincere smile, and you're trained in reading microexpressions, then you might detect a sneer for a split second under that smile. So it really depends on what the terrorist or the person who intends harm is feeling. For example, you might be just nervous about flying, and you might be trying to suppress that feeling of nervousness for obvious reasons. All we can really do is train people to recognize that there is an underlying emotion that's being suppressed to the best of this person's ability.
Nick Morgan is a communications consultant and author of communications self-help books. We've linked to Nick's blog and to information about the TSA psychological evaluations at weekendamerica.org.
And now to prisons. With tax dollars shrinking and the prison population approaching 2.4 million people, a lot of states are starting to rethink who they send to prison and for how long. Yet experts are predicting that the poor economy is going to start sending even more desperate people behind bars. Those of us who are on the outside, we rarely think about how those on the inside are spending their weekends. That is, unless you have a loved one behind bars or, in the case of crime victims, a not-so-loved one. Tomorrow is International Forgiveness Day. Forgiveness is a hard thing, especially if the offense is criminal. Reporter Nancy Mullane has a story of a Northern California program that helps crime victims find forgiveness through dialogue. And who they talk to is surprising.
A dozen men, all wearing prison blue shirts and jeans, sit in a circle inside San Quentin State Prison's Education Center. They're here for a meeting of the Victim Offender Education Group. Down at one end of the circle, Jamie Carroll, a victim and survivor, tunes her guitar. Then, as the prisoners listen, Jamie begins to tell her story.
I was thrown into the bottom of the car, and the car sped away, and I was immediately bound and had something put over my head, which I think was a burlap sack.
In a slow, steady voice, Jamie recounts how, when she was 9 years old, she says she was kidnapped and sexually assaulted.
My attack involved a knife, which was constantly used to threaten me, and also a lot of physical rape.
Jamie says she spent most of her life unsuccessfully trying to forget that day so long ago. Now she's finding some peace by telling her story to prisoners in groups like this one.
I noticed that Jamie actually had a really good voice.
Jacques Verdun is executive director of the project and oversees the groups.
So I said, "You can really sing." "Yeah," she said, but I stopped singing when I was beginning to do the healing work from the crime that I suffered as a young girl. I said, "Well, you should pick it back up." I said, "And then you should come sing for us in the group."
Jamie agreed. So today, after telling her story to this group of prisoners, she says she wants to sing again for them.
It feels really profound, actually, to do it with you guys, to do it in the presence of men that committed acts of violence and are at a place in their lives where they're definitely committed to transcending it.
That commitment hasn't been easy. Every week, hundreds of prisoners inside San Quentin attend classes in conflict resolution, violence prevention, and meditation. After years of training, Jacques says they qualify to join groups such as this one that brings victims together with offenders.
They're not their victims, so they're not personally related through the crime, but the victims have gone through crimes like the men have committed. And so there's not only a lot of healing, we think it's the most powerful, impactful tool we have.
This process might not be right for every victim, but for many it's an opportunity to ask questions and get answers from the only people who might have them, the offenders. The program was started a few years back, almost by accident, when Jacques met Rhoda Stern.
I lost my son Christopher 12 years ago. He was murdered by his school roommate, who woke up in a bad mood and shot him 4 times because he put dishes in the wrong cabinet.
Rhoda's son, Christopher Robin, was 21 years old when he was killed.
I have a real hard time understanding such intense acts of violence, how somebody could get that mad and kill somebody. It's so final. There's no graduations, there's no birthdays, there's no children, there's no marriages, there's nothing.
The death of her only son threw Radha's world into a void. The roommate was sentenced to 19 and a half years to life. She was sentenced to a lifetime without her son. Then one night at a dinner party, she met Jacques Verdun, who at the time was working with prisoners at San Quentin.
She had a son who was murdered, and I was, you know, spending my days, my working life, with people who had committed such offenses.
Listening to her story, Jacques had an insight. If he could bring the two sides of criminal trauma together, the victim and the offender, they could share their experience, the victim's weight of anguish, the offender's regret and grief, and both sides could begin to recover. So when Radha asked him about his work with the prisoners, he invited her to meet them, and the program was born.
Going into San Quentin or any prison for the first time is a pretty amazing experience. I mean, the sounds and the clanks and the guns and the guards.
Then the prisoners arrived.
I remember distinctly, you know, the men coming in one by one. And, you know, I looked them in the eye and I shook their hand. And I said, hi, I'm Radha. You know, what's your name? And then we all sat down in a circle.
The men passed photos she'd brought of her son. They listened to her story. Radha says that meeting was the beginning of her healing. But the real turning point came the day the men at San Quentin presented her with a gift.
They made me a quilt about Chris's life. It's very crude. It's only made with prison materials. I can't tell you how I felt that day. I was just so beautifully overwhelmed. And they also said, you know, we all worked together. We all did our own little square. And there was so much joy in the room while we were doing this for you.
Since that day, Radha's visited San Quentin many times. Today, she works as a facilitator in the program, helping to bring about reconciliation between prisoners and survivors. Back at San Quentin, Jamie Carroll has just finished telling prisoners in the group her memory of the day she was victimized as a young girl. There's silence. Then a hand goes up.
All I could keep thinking when you was telling it was, what a brave and smart 9-year-old little girl.
Today you touched on how healing it was for you to come in and sit with us and talk with us, share your story as well as hear ours. And we were connected in that sense. And it's so, so important. And I just want to thank you for it.
No one in this group committed any crime against her. But by listening and talking, the men are doing what they can from behind bars to heal the wounds of crime. Jamie smiles and picks up her guitar. For Weekend America, I'm Nancy Mullane inside San Quentin State Prison.
Tomorrow, Jamie Carroll will be honored along with three other women as a hero of forgiveness. It'll be at an International Forgiveness Day ceremony in San Rafael, California.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, an exercise pill, granting animals rights and then eating them, and Barack Hussein, Paris, Brittany Obama. Good news, bad news, no news is next on Weekend America. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. It's time for the segment we call Good News, Bad News, or No News, where we unite the head and the heart. We choose some of this week's news events, tell you what happened, and then decide how we feel about it. My guests are well known to you. They're celebrities, just like Paris Hilton. But are they ready to lead? That's the question. That's what we'll find out. Joining me this week are writer-producer John Ridley. Hi, John.
Hey, good day, Bill.
Also, New York Times food writer and author of How to Cook Everything, Mark Bittman. Hi, Mark.
Great to be here, Bill.
And Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Bill.
Our first topic. John McCain aired a TV ad comparing Barack Obama to Paris Hilton and Britney Spears.
He's the biggest celebrity in the world. But is he ready to lead?
And it shows him in front of big crowds chanting his name, and it shows the celebs, and you get the idea. Is this campaign tactic good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's good news if you just happen to be black, hip, and running for president.
Yeah?
I don't know if that fits anybody in particular right
sure.
now.
But generally speaking.
I say generally speaking. I mean, the idea that McCain takes out an ad that says, "Damn you, stop being so cool. Look at us. We're B. Arthur and Jack Klugman. Vote for me," is not a good campaign tactic.
But you are in the Holly world, John. Don't mass Americans look down on the celebs?
Yeah, mass Americans look down on Hollywood people until it's time to get pictures of Brangelina's babies. I mean, that people do hate Hollywood, except that they love it so much.
Hmm. Mark?
It doesn't seem like... You know, maybe something works, but it doesn't seem like they're doing anything other than lashing out in all possible directions. And then to follow this up by accusing Obama of playing the race card.
Obama said that McCain's trying to scare Americans about him. He's not patriotic enough. He's got a funny name. He doesn't look like all those other presidents
on the
dollar bill. So McCain said that's playing the race card.
Right. Well, he also doesn't look like the guys on the dollar bill because he doesn't have long, curly wigs. But... Mm-hmm. So maybe he's playing the hair card. But the point is...
He's playing the powdered wig card, which... How long must that go on?
But for whatever reason, Obama is doing well. And the fact that, you know, McCain has to resort to this, oh, he's Britney Spears, it's really pathetic.
I think this is bad news. It's evidence of what happens to your brain in midsummer. Someone thought it was a really good idea to compare Obama to Paris Hilton. I just don't get what they were thinking.
So as a college professor, though, don't you want your students to be idiots in the summer so they can really hit the ground running in September?
I am actually a great fan of lazy summers. I absolutely think the brain must lie fallow. So maybe this is good news. For on my very own reasoning, maybe it's good news.
Can I just tell you, I wish you were my professor years ago so I could just go home to my parents and say, "Mom, Dad, the brain must lay fallow." That is such a great turn of phrase. Seriously.
Thank you, John.
Our next topic. A California referendum would ban factory farms from raising chickens, calves, or hogs in small pens or cages. Livestock farmers say they want their animals to be healthy and happy, so they produce more, but they're not pets. Would this farm reform be good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I suppose you might want me to go first, but...
Food writer Mark Bittman?
It depends how the bill's written, but it's potentially great news. The way that we're raising animals in this country and increasingly around the world is damaging to the environment. It's damaging to greenhouse gases. It's damaging to our bodies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It has to change, and the change is going to be, you know, we're not all going to become vegans, obviously. The change is going to be incremental. Meat has to become, it has to be raised in a better, more conscientious way, and it has to become more expensive. And as it becomes more expensive, we're going to eat less of it. And that is ultimately a good thing for everybody.
John?
I think it's great news. I think it's wonderful that we are going to find ways to be more humane and more caring about our livestock before we make them into Happy Meals. It's a little Soylent Greeny to me that we'll pick your favorite music and put up a pretty picture and then turn you into food.
But really, John, it's not going to be like that. It's still going to be fairly hideous. It's just going to be less hideous. So you don't have to feel like it's too touchy-feely.
I like the phrase fairly hideous.
I think that's sort of disingenuous, though, John, because it just lessens the physical suffering of the animal. somewhat before we kill them. And I think that actually does matter, even to people who don't have a moral feeling about killing animals to eat them. The mark of a society is how you treat your most vulnerable components of that society. And I think there's a way in which it feeds into our feelings about other kinds of living beings, other human beings.
And I do understand what you're saying, that yes, we should try to be a little bit more humane. But to me, ultimately, once that food is on the shelf, you know, something has been destroyed to feed me. And there's a level of that's the way society has always been. I mean, hunters, you know, whether it was a spear or whether it was a slaughterhouse, there was the killing to provide.
But there are two ways about it, and there is a difference between hunting and running a factory.
Our final topic. Very reputable researchers at the Salk Institute report that they've found drugs that trick muscles into thinking they've been working out furiously. In mice, these drugs burn fat and significantly boost athletic endurance. One of the researchers said, quote, "This is not just a free lunch." He called the drug pharmacological exercise. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
I can't get a read on this thing because I just feel as if we're heading toward this brave new world of we have drugs to fix everything and, you know, why bother to do anything? So I would be tempted to say that it's bad news, but obviously for people who don't want to exercise and who want to be healthy anyway, it's probably good news.
Others?
I just don't believe that this is really what it seems to be. My gosh, you know, exercise is so much more than just getting your muscles to do a certain thing. There are skills involved and experiences and social aspects to sports.
And it hurts and it's a tremendous drag.
Pain is a great character builder. So I just think this is, it's a delusion to think that this is exercise in a pill.
John?
Horrible news.
Horrible.
There is going to be some measure of the population who will look at this pill as an opportunity to spend more time in front of the Xbox as opposed to get out and really, truly give your body what it needs. Bad news.
I take it all of you are standing right now instead of sitting like lazy bone, and you all walk and bicycle and don't
own I'm kickboxing, Bill, right now.
I feel guilty because I drove the mile in here.
Yeah, you didn't have to, did you?
It's true, but then I would have had to walk to the camp that's 3 miles away and pick up my child on my shoulders and carry her bodily home the 5 miles back to my house.
That sounds bracing.
I'd have to carry my mother, too, because she's here with me.
Okay.
You know what? I carry my mother on my back everywhere I go. Right? Metaphorically speaking, she's there.
She's always there.
She's there. You Stop always looking have a... at the girly magazines. Stop that.
That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Bill.
John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man. His latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes. Amy Hungerford is a professor of literature at Yale. Mark Bittman is the author of How to Cook Everything. Eddie writes the New York Times weekly column, The Minimalist.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
There is a reason why Thelma and Louise was not a four-hour movie. Too much of a good road trip coming up on Weekend America.
This is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. The summer is a great time to listen to live music, but what happens when a musician can't afford to get to the venue to play the music? Now that the price of gas is so high, Christopher Bell can't afford to drive to his gigs, so he's canoeing. He's lined up shows along the Erie Canal, and the indie folk rocker has had to downsize, leave behind his guitar, pack his ukulele in a waterproof bag, and he's playing his harmonica as he floats down the canal. He's in week two of his six-week tour, and he hopes to make it in time for his final gig at Manhattan's Think Cafe on September 4th. This week, we caught up with Christopher in Seneca Falls, New York, where he was sidelined by thunderstorms.
I jokingly suggested to a friend I wanted to canoe across the state, and he said, you know, that's not a bad idea. You should try it. The more I researched it, the more it just seemed like this great, excellent idea. More the reason for the canoe is part for the originality of it. I've heard of people doing biking tours. I've never heard of anyone doing a canoe tour. From between Rochester and Cayuga Lake, there's some sections where there's no fresh water coming in. So it's murkier. There's a kind of a stagnant water, which kind of gives it a bit of creepiness to it. As soon as you start heading down, the water clears up. That was really cool. I'm starting to think of nature as like an antagonist, as like this character in my life. So like when just little things, like if someone changes their hair, you know, it gives a different first impression. It's kind of the same way, like if the trees and the water, like all that affects kind of the feel of the area. I canoe anywhere from 20 to 25 miles a day. I don't really get lonely. I think that's why I can tour so much. Every time I travel with somebody, like, you can always fall back and just talk to them. But by myself, like, if I want to talk to somebody, I've got to make a new friend. And before I started touring, I thought I was an introvert. It turns out I'm quite the extrovert. And I love it, because I love meeting new people every day, and it's always interesting. With my schedule, somehow I'm keeping up with, like, the recreational boaters. I don't know how. They must go, like, 12 miles a day and then hang out for the rest of the day, because the first week I was keeping up with two groups of people in sailboats, one guy named Lonnie, who started in Erie, PA, and is going to Cocoa Beach, and then a husband and wife who started from Sandusky, Ohio, and are going to Key West. I saw them every day for the first few days, and I was keeping up with them, and it was really cool. They ended up coming out to my show. My whole album has this concept of, like, with being away and the concept of home. A lot of those kind of resonate just touring normally, but there's one called Oh How We Danced. 10,000 miles away. When you're away, things still happen back home that you really don't have any control over, and it's sometimes hard to, like, want to keep control and want to hold on to what you have back there while being away. The trip along the canal, it's inspired me. I mean, I'm still learning. There's so much more to come. But I know by the end of this, it will change me as a person.
Tonight, Christopher Bell will be docking in Ithaca to play at the ABC Cafe. He'll be concluding his tour on September 4th. And you can find out more about Christopher's canoe tour when you go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the show about the American weekend. For families, summertime is when those weekends can expand into actual vacations. That's why all summer we're bringing you stories from the road. Tamara Keith's parents were both teachers in the small town of Hanford in California's Central Valley. They had summers off. So one year, Tamara's father planned the mother of all road trips. Here's her story.
It was the summer of 1995. My brother was 9. And reading what I wrote back then, I can only figure I was a bit of a punk teenager.
For the next 6 weeks, I will be putting up with my little brother, motion sickness, unfriendly locals, and strange insects. I've heard Texas has some really huge mosquitoes, all on the quest to find America, or what's left of it. This trip is just another episode in my father's ongoing midlife crisis. 30 years ago, he went on a trip around the country, and now that my brother and I are old enough to appreciate it, he plans to give us the same experience. It seems that my father has roped us into his most recent nostalgia trip.
Well, I was thinking that it would be a really great bonding experience for the whole family.
That's my dad. I got the whole family together recently to reminisce about the trip. My brother Donovan and my mom.
It just sounded like another one of Dad's road trips where we drive and drive like 400 miles a day and he won't stop to go to the bathroom. It's like, oh my gosh.
Dad was really like big into this trip, and so I was thinking it's going to be pretty awesome.
The whole trip was carefully planned, and our space shuttle-shaped minivan made stops at virtually every major attraction and national park this country has to offer.
I enjoyed when we went to Custard's Last Stand.
And we got to pass the sign and said, free taters for out-of-staters, and then we drove to the place where they had free taters for out-of-staters.
We did see buffalo, we saw bears.
We played that game with the license plates. Animals,
and we did see Old Faithful.
Yellowstone Park.
Yes,
I was so excited to be there.
Yeah, I drove all night long.
And we drove all night. And in the morning at dawn, we ended up at Niagara Falls. And it was the most beautiful, beautiful experience.
It was 7 weeks. We were gone 7 weeks.
How did we survive?
We were fueled by candy and books on tape. We arrived in Washington, D.C. just in time for the 4th of July fireworks show on the Capitol Mall. By that point, there had been plenty of fireworks inside the minivan. I don't remember what we argued about, but Mom and I were going through a tough stage back then. Dad usually sided with me, and then she'd say we were ganging up on her. That day, Mom had a headache, or maybe she just said she did. So she stayed at the hotel while Dad, my brother, and I camped out on the mall for 6 hours in a thunderstorm. We were in the middle of this muddy, drunken mess. But it was on Dad's itinerary, so there we were. The next stop was New York City. We saw some plays on Broadway, the Statue of Liberty, Wall Street, and we went to a Starbucks. It felt so New York. And then it was on to Disney World. Soon, we were driving through the tobacco fields of the South.
The Deep South. The whole concept of being in the South really freaked me out. I've always had a theory that my California girl attitude, speaking without being spoken to, putting my elbows on the table, and refusing to say, yes, ma'am, and no, sir, could get me thrown into an alligator pit or at least a close encounter with corporal punishment, and I didn't want to test it out.
God, I was snotty back then. You know that age. I was the center of the universe.
You did kind of look out for yourself.
You're a little bratty Bratterstein.
After a week at Disney World, we spent a couple of days in New Orleans. And then with the minivan pointed towards home, we drove further and faster every day. We did take one detour, though, to downtown Oklahoma City. It had only been a few months since the bombing of the federal building there.
For me and most of my generation, this event will always be remembered. I will personally identify with the bombing as a tragic part of my life history, in much the same way as my parents and grandparents relate to the assassination of JFK or Pearl Harbor.
I know it sounds dramatic, but it was such a powerful, painful experience for my 15-year-old self. There were a lot of things on the trip that mean even more now than they did back then.
we were so lucky to see New York City before 9/11 and to experience New Orleans pre-Katrina.
Those places will never be the same as they were when we went, and those memories that we have of those places we'll own for the rest of our lives.
That was our great time to be together as a family, and it may never happen again.
My parents still have a minivan, but we're rarely in it together. Last year, my brother moved 6 hours to the south, to Los Angeles. And now my husband and I are planning a cross-country drive of our own. We're moving to Washington, D.C.
It's kind of like the end. You're moving away. He's gone. Here we are, ready to retire in about 3 or 4 years. And yeah, it's a great memory. It's a really great memory.
Oh, yeah, I remember us being this crowded in the back seat.
Packing up for another trek across the country. I'm Tamara Keith for Weekend America.
You want to play the last play game again, Tam?
California.
You can't use California. We're in California. We have to be in a different state.
Yeah, that is a clear violation of the license plate rule. By the way, before they settle down in D.C., Tamara and her husband are going to Europe. Then they're going on a 2-week cruise. Then they're driving across the United States.
Whoa.
And like her dad, I know she criticized, but Tamara says she has the itinerary tightly planned. We want to thank Molly Bloom for doing the voice of young Tamara. You can see photos from that epic journey at weekendamerica.org.
Well, there's no doubt. Summer's definitely the time for great family road trips, but I think nothing says summer weekends like relaxing around a pristine pool with a good book. Of course, I realize that not everything interesting happens between the covers of the novel when you're at the pool, because the pool is the prime place for fights and love stories and scandal and friendships. Well, today we share your tales from the backyard oasis, and we start with Jane Bratton in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
Back in 1970, 2 years after our father died, our mother decided that she and me and my brother and sister, who were all under the age of 10, would build a pool. And it was an above-ground swimming pool. My mom and us three kids actually built this pool ourselves. I remember it was very hot. Central Ohio, so June, July, it was, you know, dog day heat, a lot of allergies. I know she realized that we were just children, but, you know, she's not going to... This was not a baby kind of a job. This was, you know, pretty adult. So she would. She would just yell at us in a loving way, just pull it tighter, keep pulling it tighter, really keeping an eye on everything. I think a lot of the work really fell on our brother, who was 10. You know, the new sort of man of the family kind of a thing. We ended up with a shallow and a deep end. I don't think that was by design, but it's just sort of the way things worked out. In the evenings, my mom would come out with us, and we would do our little bathing beauty routines and our Esther, whatever that swimmer's name is, do these dances in the pool, or water ballet. After our dad died, I remember her saying things, how this will keep the family together, you know, give you something to do. We spent every day that summer and a good many summers to come in that pool.
Well, my name is Dale Brayman, and I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The best part of it for my brother and I was that we had a swimming pool. And even though it was wonderful when the other kids were over, we had the opportunity to swim at night when it was really hot. One night, our folks just said to us, "Hey, guys," and they turned out all the lights outside and turned the light out in the pool and the light out in the living room and said, "You guys, go skinny dipping." And after giggling and not figuring out what they meant, my brother and I went out into the pool. And we went swimming for the first time at night without our clothes on. And we were excited about it and didn't really get what we were doing. But as soon as we slipped in the pool and I went under the water, pushed off the side, and had that feeling of the water rushing over my body for the first time in the deep dark, I was hooked. It was absolutely the most wonderful experience that I'd ever had in my life. And by the time we were ready to get out of the pool and get called to go to bed at night, we were excited and comforted and climbed into bed, and there we were with chill bumps on a hot night. And it was just absolutely wonderful. The best way I can describe it, that I was 8 years old, felt like a man, and had absolutely no idea what that could possibly mean, and just went to bed smiling and thrilled and happy as could be.
That was Dale Brayman in Haines City, Florida. And before that, we heard from Jane Bratton in Highland Heights, Kentucky. You can see some pictures of Dale and Jane in their pool days. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
This weekend brings swimming pool weather to Hot Springs, Arkansas, around 100 degrees there. Not so much in Bangor, Maine, a rainy 72. Here's more about the weekend weather with John Moe.
Clovis, California has 97 degrees, bright sun, and people on sticks getting pretty close to that sun. The North American Pole Vault Championship features competitors from around the world, plus running and poles and stuff, plus inexplicably a petting zoo. If a sheep jumped over a really high fence via pole vault, would that put you to sleep immediately? Mount Horeb, Wisconsin is sunny, 89 degrees, and slathered in mustard. Mount Horeb's the home of the Mustard Museum and site of Mustard Days. Mustard-themed games, free hot dogs with mustard, and unveiling of the first mustard vending machine. Then everyone gets in cars and drives to the Heinz factory for a big mustard versus ketchup rumble. Relish is staying out of this one. Lots of places have clouds and temperatures of 97. Only Wendover, Utah adds in 100-pound rockets reaching 20,000 feet. It's an event called Hellfire, a rocket festival held on the Bonneville Salt Flats. It's very focused on rockets. True, they do have food and rides and restrooms, but be advised, the food, rides, and restrooms are all made of rockets. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
The weekend is when you can sleep in, which doesn't help if you can't sleep. Coming up, a solution both high-tech and beautiful on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
This weekend, Audrey Stillerman plans to hang out with her husband and kids in Chicago, go to the beach, have dinner with her mom, a normal weekend, something that used to be really hard for her because she couldn't sleep. Then her doctor suggested a new sleep aid, not a pill, just the sound of her own brain. Reporter Jim Gates has the story.
This is the sound of Audrey's brain. It's a musical representation of the electrical activity in her head, the ultimate personal soundtrack. Now, just as no two brains are alike, neither are their soundtracks. Here's what our doctor's brain sounds like. Her doctor's music is a little more uplifting, while Audrey's music is... Well, here's Audrey's brain again.
The relaxation track is very slow and kind of a lot of bass clef, but it's innocuous. I mean, it's sort of neither here nor there. I don't go around whistling it or anything like that.
Audrey was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer in January. The rounds of chemotherapy and the barrage of daily meds completely threw off her circadian rhythm. Sleeping through the night became impossible. She was exhausted and overwhelmed during the day. Then Audrey started undergoing brain music therapy. She began sleeping better than she ever had in her whole life.
In fact, I've had a couple of experiences where I woke up the next day and I literally didn't know what day it was or where I was. Not in a bad way. I mean, it wasn't frightening. It just was that I had been so deeply asleep that I was a little disoriented when I woke up.
Brain music therapy is used to help people primarily with the problem of insomnia, and that was how it was developed.
That's Dr. David Moore. He practices internal medicine in Chicago. He prescribed the music for Audrey.
What the music does, it appears, is it increases the amount of alpha rhythm that you have, and it is the progression downward towards sleep.
The brain music therapy, or BMT, helps transition the electrical activity in the brain from beta waves to alpha waves. Beta waves are more active. We produce them when we're alert and thinking. Alpha waves occur when our brains are idling, like when we daydream. From alpha, the brain can downshift to theta waves. We experience these in REM sleep. Then we move on to delta waves, which is where we enter that deep, dreamless slumber.
Now, why couldn't I just listen to Yanni? Because that's going to put me to sleep.
If Yanni puts you to sleep, do it. That's great. I love Yanni. And many people use relaxing music to help them sleep. This is a way of engineering the music specifically for you should you have a sleep disorder that wasn't amenable to Yanni.
The first step to engineering the personal composition is to make a recording of the patient's brainwaves. So Dr. Moore had Audrey come into his office for an EEG. He attached several electrodes to her scalp and measured the electrical activity in her brain. It took about 15 minutes. Then Dr. Moore emailed Audrey's reading to another doctor in New York who ran it through a computer.
That's the black box. It's a computer analysis of the mathematics of the EEG.
He calls it a black box because it uses proprietary software that belongs to only one person in the United States, Dr. Golina Mindlin, a neuropsychologist at Columbia University.
It's not really a black box for us. I mean, this is the digital program, and this is quite complex algorithm which allows to translate your brainwave frequencies into musical map.
From that musical map, a 9-minute composition of healing rhythms was created just for Audrey, brain music. Dr. Mindlin burned a CD and sent it to Audrey, who listens to it before going to sleep. Dr. Mindlin brought brain music therapy over from Russia, where it was developed at the Moscow Medical Academy in 1991. She says that music is a very efficient way to reach inside our minds and affect our brainwaves.
We all have an experience that the certain musical fragment will just stuck in your brain, right? Because it has some emotional flavor, it has some emotional connection or memories. But this is the frequencies which are yours, which are belong to you. So you are your own symphony.
And it's an expensive symphony, $550. And it's not covered by insurance. So far, about 2,000 patients have been prescribed BMT. A recent study showed BMT going head-to-head with the sleep aid Ambien and without any side effects. With a full night's sleep, patients using BMT have been able to deal better with other ailments like depression, addiction, ADD, and in Audrey's case, the anxiety of facing her cancer.
The evenings that I've used it, the next day I feel just much better able to cope with whatever comes my way, you know, whether it's an irritating situation at home or a stressful situation at work. I'm just more able to roll with whatever's going on.
Audrey has just completed her 8th and final round of chemo and hopes to eventually go back to work full time. She plans to keep listening to her brain music therapy to help with her recovery.
Some of the things that happen to your brainwaves, you could make happen other ways, like through meditation or through yoga. So I don't think that this is the only road in, but it's a very easy road in.
In Chicago, I'm Jim Gates for Weekend America.
We're listening now to Audrey's activation track. This is what she listens to when she wakes up to get her brain going again. Find out more about brain music at weekendamerica.org. We're glad you spent another hour with us here at American Public Media's Weekend America. Before we go, you know, it might be summertime to you, but for college students, the first day of school is alarmingly near. So we want to hear your stories from your first day of college. Not so much the I got all my classes, everything went perfect stories. We were thinking more the embarrassing, strange, borderline, unbelievable type of stories. If you moved into the wrong dorm room, we'd like to hear about that.
Yeah, or if your randomly chosen roommate turned out to be your arch nemesis in high school.
You got arrested in a case of mistaken identity.
Yeah, whatever it was, we want to hear more from you. Just tell us about it at weekamerica.org.
Our show is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, Ocean Kalen, and Tim Bamba.
Also, Sasha Aslanian, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, E. Okobi, Christina Pena, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. We hope you'll try out a free podcast of our program. You can get that, of course, at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Have a great weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekend is when you have time to explore your own story.
I felt ashamed to have a history book that only had a couple of pictures of African Americans who were slaves. They looked poor, they looked downtrodden, they looked miserable.
Your weekend, your story. Join us for the next Weekend America.